Welcome to What If? Digital plus Culture by Michael Culture Association. Here, we cast a light over the societal value of the digital cultural heritage sector. We look for examples of cross-sectoral collaboration, and we ask ourselves the core questions. What would look like a world where digital and culture cooperate? What are the barriers hindering these collaborations? And what can we do about it? Welcome to our listeners and to our guest speakers. My name is Marco Fiore, and I'm from Michael Culture Association. And before delving into this episode, the topic that is innovation cycles applied to the cultural sector, I would like to present you the speakers who agreed to participate in this conversation. We have with us Luis Bonnet, Director of the Cultural Management Program and Professor of Economics at the University of Barcelona. He is an expert in cultural economics, cultural management, and cultural policies. And on the other side, we have Marc Hernández Güell, Founder and Director of La Tempesta. He is a strategy and digital transformation consultant and is a specialist in digital cultural heritage. A bit about La Tempesta, which is an MCA member, works to socialize culture and bring the benefits of the information and knowledge society to everyone. In the previous meetings that we had to prepare this episode, we had a lot of conversation about the different directions in which we can go when we talk about innovation. So to frame a bit this conversation that we are having right now, I think that it would be interesting to know from you what you mean when you hear the word innovation in the cultural sector. So what's the first thing that comes to mind? Maybe, Marc, we can start with you.
Okay, yes. Well, when I was working in consultancy, I had a boss that I think had the best definition I've ever heard of innovation. He said it was about doing things better and also doing better things, you know. So it's not the same, as you can imagine. And I think it kind of summarizes what the power behind innovation. And strictly regarding the cultural sector, I think what innovation is bringing us is the chance to being able to respond to societal changes and adapt to the new, not only digital era, but all the things that society is transforming, and basically do not lose the relevance, the centrality of culture. So innovation is basically, as we see it, a skill that everyone needs. Is this better lab attitude that we need to keep the path, super rapid changing path.
This idea of skill is really interesting. And also the fact that you are really, the innovation is for you is connected to the future and the societal challenges. So future and present together. And Luis, with all the researches that you've done and your experience with the heritage institutions and with the cultural institutions in and organizations in general, what is your idea of innovation?
I want to start just not agreeing totally with what Marc just said. I think that's controversy is also a good way for being innovative. So I think that not all creative people are able to develop innovation. So you can have very good ideas, but not everyone has the capacity to be engaged in this process. Of course, this is a team process. Innovation is not something that happens isolated. That is a little bit the myth, as the myth of that disruptive innovation is the all important one. I think in the cultural sector, mainly we have incremental innovation. Mainly we have team innovation. So the conditions for innovating are very important. And I must say that even the conditions for creativity is important, because even though every single person has creative capacities, depends a lot where you are living, your socioeconomic conditions. But what that I think characterize the cultural sector is that we have very creative people, but not always we have people able to be involved in an innovative process. Because the difference between creativity and innovation is that innovation is the capacity to transform these ideas, these creativity ideas, to something that give new value to society. Could be economic value, could be social value, could be community value, but in any case, a value that means a change for society.
I see. And if you put it on one side, on if Mark was saying talking about skills, you talk about conditions and value, and I think that's it's interesting this path that you are describing, and in that sense. With this transformation, these changes, because in itself, the idea of innovation for me, from what we are saying right now, is that it's a transformative process where we have to meet some conditions at the basis, of course, and also part of translation, bringing together what the organizations do, the institutions do, to another level. So, for example, Mark, La Tempesta position itself as a translation layer between this technological innovation and cultural commons. It's important here to distinguish innovation and technological innovation because they are part of the big, this big group, the same big group. At the same time, technological innovation is a part of this big group. So I would like to hear from you in practice, what does this translation actually look like when you sit down with an institution, referring also to this skill that you were mentioning.
Yeah. Well, we like to define ourselves like agents of change. This is basically trying to intermediate, as you were referring in your question, with not only cultural institutions, but I would say also research, public administrations, and also, of course, the society itself. All that are part of research projects. We work closely with cultural institutions, delivering services at various levels, like at the very digitization level, but also management, and also all the resources to valorize its content and its knowledge and to reach a wider audience. So in our case, we see like we are in the middle of this. Some call it quadruple helix. Of course, we are a private company, but we feel we are walking along all the vertex of this helix. And at the end, it all starts with having the right questions, I think. It all starts with strategy. For an organization like ours, being research, being cultural organization, being a civil society's organizations, what are we expected to have, like to be fully integrated into the knowledge and information society? How can innovation help us to respond to these changes and expectations and ever-changing expectations that citizens have also on our work? Are we fully exploiting these benefits and the potential in the cultural sector and the heritage? And also how can this help us establish better connections with other sectors, communities, so how we can better fit and connect with our ecosystems? So, yeah, basically, I would say it all starts with having this inner needs clear and also the user expectations fulfilled, and asking these questions at the various levels, as I said before.
I see that this importance of outlining the basic questions and the needs and getting to the core of the issue. You mentioned when you were talking about the quadruple helix. Can you tell us a bit more about it? How does it structure? How does it influence innovation in general?
Well, this is basically innovation theory. I think Luis perhaps can better respond to this. But There is a role in this theory for research centers and universities. And basically what they say is that this role is combined with also the private companies that are able to receive this innovation and transfer it to the cultural institutions that can better serve, in this case, the citizens. And also the citizens are not only receiving this, but actively participating in reusing, creating, co-creating, and being part of this. We even now add another note to this, Alex. It's the sustainability, the environment, because all things must be done in a sustainable way. So the problem comes when, well, the fact that, for example, AI is led right now by the big tech companies. You know, it's not like the model perhaps expects that the research is delivering this innovation or this basic research, but the research comes from, the big innovations come from the private sector, like we are experiencing now with AI. You know? So how is this like kind of affecting or altering the expected flow of innovation and transmission? I think this is something that gives like another perspective also.
Mm-hmm. I see. And on this point of interaction of different parts of the sector, different stages, let's say, of innovation, innovation cycles. Luis, I would like to ask you, Mark really talks about the uptake by the sector of innovative solutions. You've observed that in very similar institutional contexts, some people may but embrace the innovation and other might resist entirely. This is not only on a technological level, but innovation per se, as we do things, as we frame the discourse in general in cultural institutions and organizations. What is the difference for you in who is ready to innovate their workflows and how they think about society who resists to it? Is it a question of, for you, an individual mindset, or there are structural conditions that we're not talking about enough and could be solved in a specific way?
Well, I think that human beings, we want to be in our comfort zone. But society is changing very fast. And if we decide to just be in our comfort zone, we are in a losing position. So innovation is the answer in order to be able to adapt ourselves. The people who are in comfortable positions, maybe, I don't know, in the public sector, if we compare with freelance artists who are trying to survive. So when you are a freelance artist trying to survive, your comfort zone is not to be where you are. Your comfort zone is to be able to go farther. So I totally agree with what Mark said before when he talked about the cross-fertilization as the key aspect that allow societies to innovate. And this is connected to what I said before about the importance of being involved on different typologies of teams. Teams doesn't mean to be an innovation team in a formal corporation. No. In the cultural sector, is much more this cross-fertilization is open to many different levels and people. So it's more to be in a creative environment, in an innovative position. And in this place, the key issue, as Mark said before, is be able to formulate the right questions. And that is part of the process, able to formulate the right questions, which so many times means that are not in your comfort zone. But at the same time, when you formulate the right questions, that means that you are evaluating the needs, the challenges, but you have to connect this with your available resources, your available assets. And this connects with what Mark said before as well, which was the idea of the skills. Which kind of skills do we need in order to go further? So really try to answer these right questions from the assets and from the resources available, what we are able to do. And when we connect this with a normative framework during decades and decades, in the last two centuries, mainly, there were an agreement about the copyright and intellectual right system. So when you were participating, I don't know, in an opera, it was clear that which percentage was for the person who wrote the libretto, the person who was writing the music. It was an agreement after a lot of battles between different stakeholders. The problem is that now, and AI is a very clear example of what is happening, the normative paradigm is change. So, in a way, we are in a moment that the idea of a temporary monopoly that could allow you to get money back from your investment, the time you have been conceptualizing, developing, and so on, and this temporary monopoly situation that allows to risk yourself, now it's not as clear as it was before, because the normative framework is not anymore a safe place, because we work much more on this shared collaborative approach. So when a private company tries to do their best to answer these questions, when the public sector is investing some public resources in order to allow and to give a framework where the research community is trying to give a better vision or to invest in basic research in order to open new spaces, all these things happens in a quite uncertain situation. So, in a way, if we are not able to innovate, we are not able to answer the right questions. There are people who and institutions who are in a safer position. They don't want to change too much, and they try to propose the questions, propose the things that benefits them, not what benefits the society. Because, of course, if they open too much, they lose this power position. And when we see that in the current geopolitical situation, that we are going back to realism, so the idea of the ones who holds the power, the hard power, is the ones who dominates the other. So this is not what we try to do when we talk about innovation in the cultural sector, so because we need freedom, because we need possibility to share the benefits of this innovation. So that's, of course, generates barriers, new barriers. So because the framework is changing and changing to directions that we don't know exactly what will happen.
I see. And another notion that is coming out from what you're both saying is the importance of risk-taking in all this and the capabilities of institutions, the skill and the ability of the institutions to face this uncertainty and the possibility of taking risks in this domain. So all the discussion also about cross-fertilization connected to taking risk and being able to formulate the right questions for a microcultural association is, of course, something very central in what we do, because being at a crossroads with multiple sectors, the technological sector, the cultural heritage sector, and the reuse sector, for those that reuse heritage, digital heritage, we see that the importance of meeting people, that are not exactly from your sector and are coming with different questions. So you cross-fertilize also this, let's say, the research for needs in the in that domain can widen a bit also our vision and can help us to ask the right question. That this is a really, really interesting. Keep in mind that I will probably ask you later what are the correct questions that you would ask. But before that, I would like to switch a little bit. At one point, Luis was talking about the AI and this idea of dominance also. And this brings us to the discussion about digital sovereignty in European infrastructure. Right now, the idea of open source standards and alternatives to big tech is taking a lot of traction and is becoming more and more part of the multiple sectors vocabulary, especially the cultural one. But this idea of digital sovereignty, European digital sovereignty, do you feel in your experience that is something that is really changing at an institutional and organizational level, how institutions and organizations make decisions? Or is it just a discussion that we are having? Are these just words that are not being implemented? In this side, I know that Mark, you talked and you worked a bit about it. So maybe I let you start so that you tell us.
Thanks. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think the convincement on the virtue of the open access and open standards to describe content and to share content is something that it's already, I would say, in the core of the cultural and heritage sectors. It's not something we don't need to convince almost no one. Everyone is already convinced, I would say. And if we want to collaborate, we have to also share some common ground to let us our content dialogue with other one, with the other institutions' content. And on the other hand, regarding infrastructure and the tools being used, I think there is kind of in a certain way, the public administrations and the tender processes are not being that strict on going open and going for open source. This is something that perhaps will change because of the side effects that people are experiencing right now. I mean, I know it will be like a fully convincement, but the reality is bringing enough examples to kind of go for digital sovereignty as an open source tools like first choice. I mean, we are realizing how 3D models, for example, are under platforms like Sketchfab that are owned by super big video game company in North American one, and almost all the 3D models are for cultural institutions are also there. And so it's not something that it's bad to be there, but or good. It's just if it's only there, this is the problem, because then you're compromising your most valuable assets. And if you are a knowledge-based organization and your strategical asset is owned or maintained and sustained by a weak agreement with a super big tech company that follows the rules of techno-capitalism, which is I can change, I can be bought, I can change my terms and conditions, and nobody guarantees your sustainability, your digital preservation. I mean, this is also happening with AI. I mean, at the extent that if you are depending on also agreements or contracts that can be changed one from one day to another. So our approach here is always diversify, look for this auditable and open code that, I mean, I know I will always have the chance to go to look forward into and not depend on only one actor. And it's in terms of transparency, of terms of sustainability, of preservation, we think it's the best. And we are happy also to see that Eurostack, ECOS, and all these flagship projects that are being deployed and at the European level also are emphasizing this need for not only sovereignty, but to base that basic infrastructures, the knowledge bases being open. not only for the content, but also for the technologies behind that. So our ambition as a company is, of course, knowing all the technologies and also always knowing what is the best. But I think we also do, I would say, advocacy for tools that are following what we know it's all, it's more aligned with the core needs and values of the cultural and organizations. It's not like you don't have to follow only what's there. You have to make a conscious decision of what is serving better your needs and the needs and the sustainability of your organization.
What you're saying really reflects the idea that open solutions and a different paradigm for what is digital infrastructure and sovereignty in general is really tightly connected to, we could say, European values. Then we should talk about what are these European values, but nevertheless central to it is there is the question of freedom that also Luis was highlighting, the importance of choice and the importance of going in these directions. Luis, do you in on this note, do you have anything to add to what Mark was saying about digital sovereignty and importance of choice and the importance of creating open solutions?
Well, as Mark said, digital sovereignty is a very important goal, but at the same time is a very complex goal to be achieved, because we live in a very asymmetric position where these big tech companies, the big platforms, the ones that decide the algorithms that people arrive to the different cultural products and digital products in general, these people has a real, very unbalanced position in relation to the rest of the value chain actors. So many times they take advantage of our open access and open source philosophy to benefit themselves. And they offer quite good solutions, software solutions, many times, that convince people that the easiest way to preserve, to work, to develop, is that using what they are offering you. But the problem is that we are giving a value that which is not clear that they will give back this value. So it is an asymmetric position. So that's a huge challenge that the European authorities are trying to discuss and to find solution. But it's not an easy there is not an easy issue. So we have to work on this direction, but at the same time we have to be realistic on what we can achieve and in which way. And because this is like the challenge between defending democracy and people who abuse of the democratic rules to impose their own ideas to the rest of the people and to impose their own interests. So in a way, we have to be aware about this in order to find the best solutions for the benefit of the whole society, not of a few. But this is the big challenge. So, but coming back to what the cultural sector and the heritage sector could do, I think that finally, when we talk about innovation, we talk on this incremental innovation that we learn from others, that we have, we can have some very specific singular solutions or some very singular assets or art pieces of heritage, which this is really something that depends of human being capacity of not just giving value, but of sharing value and to create and to empower the community. And that make people aware about what we are coming from, what we can do. So this idea of empowerment and empower society and a creative society. So I think that's something that is quite handmade, to say in a way. So, and that's why I think there is space for developing very interesting solutions. And if we work, think about how pilots could be the source of allowing and finding new ideas, new innovations, a process of changing. So I think that's I think is the way to go.
I see. I know that we are finishing a little bit our time. Before going to our last question and imagining futures, I would like to ask Mark a very precise question about your, in relation to what we said up to now, as AI becomes increasingly embedded in the way specifically cultural heritage is accessed, a theme, of course, that is very near MCA approaches to musical transformation. What would a responsible private company's line in the sand actually look like?
Well, let me tell you first that we are super excited to what AI is bringing, at least in the cultural and cultural heritage sectors. I think we are facing a super interesting moment right now, where we are all to redigitize also and content that was there, perhaps that was only scanned, but we can now make these documents be much more eloquent and to bring all the deepness of content and information that is there hidden. For example, we are transcribing manuscripts from the 19th century and 20th century, not necessarily from medieval times, but more contemporary modern times. And there is such an amount of hidden information there that is now going to the surface by thanks to the AI. Or we are just applying it to old cartography, old maps, and then we identify, thanks to the computer vision, visual elements like ships and also the texts that are written there, and persons and mythological beings there, like mermaids. And all this can be then added to the metadata and being searched and activated. And the knowledge that we have of our collections is much improved. I think AI in cultural and sector and serves basically all these access and also interpretation. We have this cognitive also mediation that AI is bringing. And that is for me what my interest here with AI. Of course, we need a deontological perspective also. I mean, we cannot use or do something because technology allows us to. I mean, we cannot compromise, break the data protection or and AI should be like accountable. I mean, we should also find if this data protection is broken, we should find where this was broken. And but I mean, this is a whole new science or the AI ethics. So we have the AI Act. We have also the UNESCO recommendations for ethics and AI. We have like these frameworks that are defining all these boundaries of what is done properly or what is risking practices. And yeah, I have to say, in our experience or personal experience, we are basically interested in all this mediation and better digitization of the content. Not really or trying to avoid all these other users that compromise privacy. Yeah.
And on this subject, a lot of the things that you're saying were also reflecting in a recent work that I'm sorry, I've told to promote us a little bit our MCA.
A great work. You can promote it. It's an excellent work you did there.
We recently worked with a group of 140 people that is called an action group on digital and AI in collaboration with Cultural Action Europe. And this group is aimed at bringing the cultural perspective in digital policies in the EU. And the most recent work was about recommendations for an AI strategy for culture and creative sectors that the European Commission is currently creating. And we see, of course, that this element of trust and this element of seeing at the good things that the technology in this sense can bring us, but at the same time, having a clear look on what are the baselines that shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't be surpassed in terms of ethical issues. If our listeners want to have a look at it, you will find it on Michael Culture's website. And with all this in mind, with all we said about innovation and with all the things that are coming right now for Europe in terms of the new funding cycle with the multi-annual financial framework, we're going to see a lot of chip put into innovation in general. The core question of this podcast is, what if? Let's think about alternative futures. Let's think about the ideal world that we would like to see. And in this specific case, how we would like to be to see innovation treated in a policy side, a political level, but also at institutional level, because this is what you have more experience with. So if I ask you, what if? An alternative world, an ideal world, perfect world where innovation is seen and treated as you imagine should be done. Luis, what you have to say about it?
For me, the key is the good balance between the local and national level and the international cooperation level, in the sense that culture needs to be very close to their own roots, to the freedom of expression of the artist in connection with the value of the community, but in connection with what the community is needed. So this idea that the creators grows up in particular environments, but that has to be done in a way where cultural cooperation at the international level is working well. This is important because that opens your mind to things that happens in other parts of the world, opens your mind to intercultural relations, but without losing who you are from your own roots, from your own culture. So this is the crucial issue. And I think this is the battlefront. We have to work in order to give to culture the possibility to be an empowering force.
Yes, sir. And Mark, you can close this discussion.
Yeah.
Difficult.
Well, that's the tough question, I guess. But yeah, innovation, I guess when it's focused on people and content and not only on technology, but then it's a good start. And sometimes it's true that technology defines new paradigms, and we should be able as a cultural institutions or members of this ecosystem to critically position ourselves. It's not doing things because they are there or because they can be done. It sounds pretty obvious, but it's sometimes, we should be always able to assess if this is going to be aligned with our core values or not. This is on one side, on let's say the organization side and on the public administration side, I think. We should not trust only in values, but also have the structural means that innovation can flow through these open infrastructures and that can reach everyone, not only like the top of the rank organizations or the most, let's say, well-financed ones. Everybody should be able to keep the path of innovation and to respond to these societal changes that we were referring to at the start of this podcast. So it's kind of, on one side, asking ourselves, how can we be present in the digital space, but also in how we can respond to these challenges that we are facing, how innovation is helping us being more present and being more relevant. And on the other hand, like the regulators taking the steps not to leave hold to values, but also to make the investment and try to socialize all these benefits of innovation.
Yeah, I see. So for me here, the bottom line is that innovation is an action. It is a sector that in per se that leads the way, but at the same time, the core values that are at the center of it are responding to societal challenges and to finally make the world a better place for everyone, specifically also in this case, as we discussed, for the cultural sector. There would be so many things to talk more about, but our time is ending. I invite the listeners to have a read. Mark has some interviews online published. Luis has a lot of research. Please visit also the website of La Tempesta, and you will find all the elements and additional resources in the description of this podcast. Let me thank Luis and Mark for this contribution. This was very interesting, a little bit tricky to go through all the things, but I think that we ended up with some good elements that will be channeled also in our advocacy efforts in general. So thank you very much, Mark and Luis.
Thank you to you.
Thank you very much too. And thanks also to Luis.